Which case is this, that the McDonnell-Sound issue really is the deciding issue for the whole case? I know there are just numerous issues that have been raised by the parties, but there are these central deciding questions here. I mean, that's what it is.
It is the threshold issue as it relates to Mr. Chung, and I believe it relates only to Mr. Chung and not the other defendants. But there are, as we point out, at least three or four other reasons why the district court's action should be overturned, and in particular the default vacated at a minimum in the manner of returning them, or upon your review of our motions for judgment on the pleadings, if we find them to be meritorious under a de novo standard, it could be remanded with instructions to the district court to enter judgment in favor of the defendants, or at least Mr. Chung and Mr. Kim. And I don't mean by focusing on the subject matter jurisdiction to in any way suggest that the arguments related to failure of service, lack of service, are meaningless or wrong. There really is no evidence that Mr. Chung was served.
Counsel, at some point in your argument here, I would appreciate your addressing in some detail the issue of the standard for whether there should have been relief from the default judgment. Because I thought that might have been your strongest argument, even stronger than jurisdiction or service. Just that the default judgment here probably shouldn't have stood.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and if I may, I might refer to my co-counsel for Mr. Kim to address that particular point. I'll be glad to address it briefly.
That's fine with that. As long as I hear somebody address it before we're done, I'm okay.
Well, I think in a nutshell, the motion to set aside default was filed relatively early in the lawsuit. There had been some very questionable attempts, if not outright ineffective attempts, to accomplish service on at least Mr. Chung and Mr. Kim. The parties in their application, Rule 55 application, raised meritorious defenses, but to us, the cap on this is that as the service on Mr. Chung and service on Mr. Kim, it simply did not comply with the rules and statutes under which it was purported to have been done, which would have required the district court to vacate the default judgment.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve what time? 20 seconds, I have left for about a minute.
Okay.
Let's hear from your co-counsel.
Okay.
Your co-counsel, your colleague.
May it please the court. In the context of a civil proceeding, this case presents an extreme example of injustice.
Could I ask, since your colleague expressly referred to you, do you have something more you think you want to address on the conclusion?
With regard to the standard of review as relates to setting aside the default, I believe that de novo standard of review is required in this matter, not only under Ninth Circuit case law, but throughout the country. All courts are unanimous. Which I don't know how often that happens.
It keeps asking about the standard of review, DeNovo versus Superior, or use of discretion. It keeps asking about that.
I think the simplest, Mr. Kim has presented many grounds to set aside the default. I think the simplest one, having spent a lot of time with the case, is that the second amended complaint superseded the complaint on which a default was entered, thereby rendering the default void. In the next.
But those things that they amendment, the whole implies that both the defendants and the defendants that the defendants are charged on the same
way. First, I would say the allegations here are of conspiracy, so that allegations relating to one defendant effectively impact all defendants. But in this case, Rule 15d tells a plaintiff exactly how to supplement the complaint if they just want to add some more detail. That rule says you move pursuant to 15d, you supplement, you don't lose the prior complaint. The case law in the Ninth Circuit under Rhodes says if you're going to amend a complaint, it treats the prior complaint as non-existent. And in Thermal Life, we have a district court that specifically addresses this question: what happens to a default when an amended complaint supersedes the one in which default was entered? Now, to me, that one is the simplest way to address setting aside the default, but I think there are also very and really more compelling grounds. So then I would go for the next grounds, which are with regard to the original complaint for Mr. Kim, he was allegedly served by publication under Arizona law. The Arizona law is very clear that you must show due diligence as part of your process when you attempt to serve by publication. First, you have to show due diligence in attempting to serve personally. The Sprang case details what you have to actually say. You can't just say, we didn't know where he lived. You have to actually detail what you want to figure it out. Your Honor, I would respectfully say that the record ties not one fact to Mr. Kim evading service, and he did not evade service. He lived in his house for the last 20 years. They personally visited his house. He never evaded service. And actually, what really happened here is Matinee Corporation in Tucson, Arizona, had shut its offices. The person running Matinee was Paul Young, who is the absent criminal, so to speak, the fraudster. He was definitely evading service. And the error here was the court didn't look at each individual separately to say, okay, is this party evading service? Let me see what evidence there is. There is no evidence in the record whatsoever of any evasion by Mr. Kim. And he reasonably thought, because they came to his house, that he would be served personally. He also made some, at most, negligent errors. He talked to his colleagues. He was an investment banker in New York. He knew a lot of lawyers there. And he said, hey, am I supposed to be served before I must answer? And they all said, oh, you can't be served by publication. You will have to be personally served. And he was available always to be personally served. And they said, until that happens, you don't have to answer. That was wrong. It turns out in New Jersey, there's no publication. You can't serve by publication, just as in the federal rules. But that was an error at most. It was an intentional bad faith to avoid service. So I think the critical point is there's no evasion by Mr. Kim. And all the bad acts of Matinee were actually undertaken by Paul Young. It also were not attributable to him because Mr. Kim isn't being sued as a corporate officer in that capacity. He's being sued as an individual who will be personally liable. There needs to be personal service. And he hasn't done anything to evade service. There's no record of that whatsoever. And in fact, that wasn't the case. In addition to all what I've said here, Paul Young at that time, of course, he doesn't know that the guy is a professional crook. He told Kim, hey, I've got this. Why don't you send me some money for a retainer and I'll hire some lawyers for our defense, our joint defense. So Mr. Kim sends over $15,000 and he says, and this is all before the default is entered. So Mr. Kim is told, yes, I will hire lawyers and we will defend this lawsuit. And Mr. Kim says, well, what's happening? What's happening? Have you hired lawyers? And then Paul Young, the bad guy, says, oh, you know what? I had to use that money. There were some very exigent expenses that I had to deal with, so I haven't had a chance. Can you send over some more? So not only is Mr. Kim taking all the steps, sending over the money for the retainer, believing that his defense is going to be put up, but also as an individual, he's done nothing to evade service whatsoever. He truly is a victim here, which is another exceptional reason.
Counsel, if you could just run through the full litany of the arguments you have as to why a default judgment should be set aside, not not limiting it to the fact of the alleged complaint.
Absolutely. So the sort of short version is there was never service of any complaint. So the publication was defective. The first amended complaint was concededly mailed, which does not affect personal service. And it's also not giving you personal jurisdiction since there wasn't any originally. Then the second amended complaint supersedes the earlier complaints, which we believe also renders it self-serving. Then the next round is it's also the case that it should be set aside as void under all the case law that says you can at any time without regard to waiver bring a motion to set aside a default as void because of those grounds of lack of service, personal jurisdiction. Then the next set of grounds, which is what I call equitable grounds, are that there is good cause to set aside the default here. That is because the default was introduced 3 months. The motion to set aside the default was raised just 3 months into the default. The amount of money is $3 million for an individual. That is a lot of money. The other ground is that the merits, Mr. Kim wants his day in court. He was not connected with any fraud. This man will turn 70 next year and had never been sued in his life, even though he was an investment banker where suits can happen pretty frequently. He has an impeccable reputation. Integrity meant everything to him. This case, the money is something, but the reputation is huge. So he has meritorious defenses. Not all these procedural things, he has those in abundance, but he has actual defenses. And right from the get-go, from the first motion to set aside the default, he has an affidavit where he says, I did not do anything wrong. And actually, if I may just... In the reply, at the back of the reply, I have a pleading table, and it is kind of handy because it sets out what he said and when. So in the first motion to set aside the default, just 3 months into the case, Mr. Kim says that... Mr. Kim contested the factual basis for contractors' claims, contending the complaint was a massive work of smoke and mirrors, and that there were numerous facts to be determined by a finder of fact before any finding of liability could be had. He then also said the defendants owe nothing to plaintiffs. So that was the very first affidavit saying on the merits, not just all these procedural things, but hey, I didn't do anything wrong here. And in fact, I'm confident that if he's given that opportunity, I actually think even the plaintiffs would concede that he wasn't the bad guy. He was victim too, but they're looking for money.
Okay. Just close that answer. Let's sit down. We'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal, and let's hear from counsel for the plaintiffs now. You've got a lot of ground to cover.
Please, the court, good morning, your honors. Daniel Hall for Appeals, Jeff Solder, Eric Park, and Hoover Technology. Would your honors refer back to simply address the issue that Ms. Cruz did?
Is that the only one?
Well, I was going to address the waiver issue, your honors, because it seems to concur the bulk of the appellant's argument in this matter.
The waiver of the judicial service argument?
Correct. The waiver of personal jurisdiction, your honor.
Well, okay, yeah, I have a question about that, so why don't you start with that?
Okay. Your Honor, as I'll briefly mention just now that the history of the case in this matter, appellees have filed a complaint in August 2012.
So the very first filing they made, ready for relief from the default, they both assert that service was deficient. So the AM does not wait for that person to argue. You're not taking that, right?
Your Honors, under many clips and how I believe in many years, I think the case laws are very clear that you must raise the defense of personal jurisdiction in the first available plea.
Separate, I can't remember now the name of the case you're talking about, it's separate, not personal jurisdiction, is separate from the defense of the service process, right? And so they're not, you don't need to assert lack of personal jurisdiction in the sense that, they lack minimal contacts, I see there, so they're not arguing that.
Well, they're just arguing that service was deficient. Well, you're trying to argue on that, I believe that that's not personal jurisdiction based on the instance of this service. And the court didn't have that out, and they would have had to raise the authority to raise that.
Well, they told the court, that's what I'm saying, they told the court right out of the box, look, you don't really have any basis for going forward with this suit against us because we were never properly served out. Well, what was deficient about that?
Well, what you're saying, what was going on? Well, again, on the case law, we believe for cause leaves to declare that such an issue must be raised, and our position would be that they failed to raise it distinctly and specifically.
So I guess, you know, if we're not communicating, he said to the court, Judge, he did not serve us properly, so we're not, we should be before you as things stand now. They made that argument, you can see that, right?
They simply said that they contested the service and submission of process of service. Mr. Chung, he already used that argument.
So you're saying that they didn't properly preserve even the deficiency in the service and process of
service? I don't
know what the argument is. So all I'm saying is that we have cases that say if service was deficient, that alone is a ground for vacating a default judgment. And so what are they waived?
Again, we see no way of preserving the issue of the current personal jurisdiction in the center because the candidate didn't raise it.
Let's say we don't agree with you on that. Why don't you address the merits? Because I think you have real problems with the fact that both of them
are. Let me even switch to the reasons why the lower court was correct in affirming the refusal to set aside the default. This court currently found that Mr. Kim failed to offer any evidence or argument to say even one disjunctive fact.
I don't know. That answers my question first.
In all fairness
of the service, whether the service was proper,
I'll defend that
because I think you have problems with both the system. There's going to be both.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Chung, his argument is that service was insufficient because it was served upon an administrator of the firm. We would disagree, Your Honors, in the sense that
the statute requires you to show that you exercised reasonable diligence to serve in custody before you resorted to serving in that usual place of business. What evidence would you put in that you would engage in reasonable efforts to find him and serve him personally?
These weren't able to raise that issue with the lower court, Your Honor, and they didn't raise that issue.
He raised that right out of the box. That was the very first filing. He said, I have not been properly served. What did you put in the record to show that actually you had complied with that California statute?
It was my understanding, Your Honor, that after the motion to set aside the default was denied, that the appellate filed a motion for reconsideration. So only at that time did he specifically raise the issue that service was improper because the firm administrator was served. At that point, we did respond. Service in that matter was proper because it was an issue where it was done. That service out of six of business upon the individual.
Well, you're just wrong. I mean, I'm looking at the minutes posted that they consist specifically treat you as not authorized to receive service. And you raised the issue. Let me ask you again because you obviously didn't want to just answer a question directly. What evidence did you put in the record to show that you had engaged in reasonable diligence efforts to serve you personally before you resorted to serving the administrator of the law firm? What evidence did you put in the record?
Again, Your Honor, we didn't.
If the answer is none, just say none. Is the answer none? Then you can give your excuse for why there wasn't any. There's just nothing but the answer,
Your Honor, for there wasn't any evidence.
And then it was in the because
we didn't have a chance to meet in the record. We didn't have any evidence to see that the state's denied this.
Okay, do you want to make anything you are saying? It's your opinion. You're going to look at the document. Look at page ER907. Do you have that in front of you?
I'm going to get on the other.
Yes, please. I'm going to get it to you. Did you say right there?
That the law firm was not authorized to accept service. It was deficient.
That's the very first thing that they filed. So, I guess, why did you not have an opportunity to respond to that by saying, well, here's how we actually did comply with that contract decision?
Well, Your Honor, you said that that was a moot issue because, once again, they waived it in the sense that the person's jurisdiction was waived. That seems a moot issue, but even regardless of that, Your Honor, we contended that service was proper and that it was left with the service was made upon a person that would know what to do, which would be dealing with the duties when served. Furthermore, under Rule 4, it would do it any state law rules in terms of service. In this matter, it can't be disputed that both appellants had received constructive notice at the very least. They responded to the meeting 1 month after the complaint was filed, acknowledging that the complaint was filed and that they were aware of it, yet they intentionally chose not to answer to that complaint. And furthermore, Your Honors, even if service was improper, we contend that it's not because, again, the complaints were before the federal rules.
How about the other defendant, Mr. King?
Mr. King is claiming that service on publication was ineffective, but again, I think that this report correctly found that he was avoiding service.
Your opponent says that there is not one shred of evidence in the record to suggest that he personally avoided service. I do agree with her. So what do you, again, what evidence do you have on the record?
I disagree with him, Your Honors. Again, I'd like to remind you that Mr. Kim, he's the CEO and the vice chairman of this M&A company that apparently fled.
And there you go. You have to show that you made diligent efforts to find him and serve him personally as an officer. You're serving him as an individual, right?
Yes, sir.
So what did you do to go find him since you immediately went to Arizona?
We looked for him in Tucson, and we also looked for him in New Jersey. But
as a reporter at the record, do you have any description of what your process server people did to find him in New Jersey? Because I couldn't find him.
But what happened, Your Honors, and this report even noted this, is that people that appellants, appellees, excuse me, we did not know until after the motion to consideration was filed in their reply brief, that for the first time ever, that's S. Jin Kim, as opposed to his full name, was Sung Jin Kim. And only then were what parties were able to find where he lives in New Jersey. And up until then, despite the efforts of appellees to try and locate Mr. Kim in New Jersey, they were unsuccessful because his name was not correctly disclosed, as opposed to the records in New Jersey. So again, to continue with why the defaults, non-sittings aside, the defaults to be affirmed, Your Honors, is that, again, as mentioned, Mr. Kim and actually both Mr. Rachan did both respond to this mention through the media just mere months after his complaint was filed for Mr. Kim. And this report actually correctly noted that this is not a case where using a form of alternative services caused Mr. Kim to be uninformed of the complaint against him. And it noted that newspaper articles showed which articulated how the company had fled in the middle of the night. Employees weren't paid, and there was no type of address to be found. So the court correctly found that Mr. Kim did engage in culpable conduct, and there's no doubt that that culpable conduct is when someone withholds $2 million of your money and moves to another state without informing you, and then occasionally fail to respond to a complaint. This court, again, also found that there were no meritorious defenses made in the sense that
we just heard him argue that there were no meritorious defenses that Mr. Kim
Well, if I could direct you to their very, very first finding, their motion to satisfy default, their defense is that this is relegated to basically 19 sentences in the motion where they simply say, because of the extreme complexity of the complaint, it is not feasible to respond item by item in this motion to set aside default, and critically, this ignore we respectfully suggest as necessary. They just merely glossed over that, and they needed to have specifically and distinctly raised these meritorious defenses. So as a result, the court concluded that no meritorious defenses were raised.
Could it be argued that at each stage of an attempt to set aside the default on behalf of the hearer or whatever that is, the defendant's explanation became more intensive?
Your Honor, I think it's important to remember here, this wasn't just a cursory examination by the court of this issue of setting aside the default. As the district court notes, after the order came out denying that entry to set aside the default, 3 years were spent considering and reconsidering whether to set aside this default. I think it's also important to note how, with regard to Mr. Chung, again, the court allowed limited discovery and allowed Mr. Chung to bring the reader's motion, but still, even then, based upon the aggregate evidence before them, they still determined that Mr. Chung's domicile remained in Maryland. Just as Mr. Russell argues, if I understand correctly, he seems to dispute the standard of review based on the factors. But my understanding is that Mr. Chung, in his opening brief on page 14, he agrees that the factors for determining personal asylum are essentially factual, and that's the clearly erroneous standard should be applied to the district court's factual findings, including his credibility evaluation of Mr. Chung. Clearly, the court found certain aspects of Mr. Chung's evidence as suspect. The district court's determination that the bill is established by a preponderance, again, of the aggregate, is not simply just on the residence issue. Obviously, we disturb the court should apply this highly deferential, clearly erroneous standard, and only if it's allowed for the definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been committed by the district court should this decision be overturned. Furthermore, I think when you look at the numerous factors here, Mr. Chung, he concentrates his argument on the resident presumption, but again, as Your Honors has mentioned in the answering brief, that residence presumption is not followed by the Ninth Circuit and this circuit, that presumption is not followed. Instead, it's the presumption of continuing domicile that this circuit has adopted. Furthermore, in terms of Mr. Chung's opening analysis, again, I think it's important to note that Mr. Chung consistently, repeatedly, because he keeps mentioning his Maryland address to establish ties to it. In 2002, when he moved to South Korea, he states under oath in the mortgage document that the Maryland address, his home there, is his permanent home. In 2004, although again during discovery, he did not that he had never voted in the United States after he moved to Korea, it was found that he voted in 2004 in the U.S. presidential election and he used his Maryland address there. In 2006, 2010, 2013, when he applies for his non-immigrant visa in South Korea, he used again his Maryland home address as his permanent home address. 2012, when he makes a contribution to Canada for the U.S. House of Representatives, he uses his Maryland house address. His car, which again he didn't disclose to the court, and the court noted that that was a maybe this was a suspect.
Mr. Counsel, as Judge Gould, if I can interject, assuming for a moment that we conclude that the court had jurisdiction and the service of process was correct, what argument would you have as to a reason why the default judgment shouldn't be set aside to let the matter be decided on the merits?
Your Honor, I hear that point. It would be a colleague's contention that they waived personal jurisdiction again. And in this matter, this isn't a situation where the default is unfair or it's a technicality, Your Honor.
I guess I'm asking you to assume they disagree with you.
Okay.
Well, jurisdiction,
regardless, see,
assume we say there is jurisdiction and the service was adequate to bring these defendants into the court. Why should there be a default judgment against them as opposed to a decision on the merits?
Your Honor, I think it's important to note that they were aware of the complaint. They had actual and constructive notice. They deliberately failed to respond to for reasons still unknown. And again, it's important to note that the lower court, they put themselves in the shoes of the appellants, I believe, and they still analyzed in detail whether or not the fall should be set aside. And again, as Your Honors know, the standard to set aside the default or not is if the defendants even lie anyway. But yet, they still went and they examined the service issue, whether that was proper or not, and eventually they still found service to be effective. And in this case, this is not a case, Your Honor, whereas Mr. King's case states that he's a victim of fraud, as the lower court even noted. Excuse me, please. Or both Mr. Kim and Mr. Kim were not simply victims of another man's fraud. Both men held especially responsible positions at Matinee, and it's not unfair to apply knowledge and intent to Matinee by both of them. Both Mr. Kim and Chung knew or should have known about the corporate structure whereby Samson served as Matinee's agent. both undertook overt acts and made false statements upon which contractors relied when making false statements to their agencies. We're still in a situation here where my clients, they're still out nearly $2 million, Your Honor. So, I guess to further address this point, Mr. Chief Justice, also think that you answered my question.
I have a follow-up question.
And I don't mean to beat a dead horse, because I may be wrong. But assuming we thought there was jurisdiction and service was okay, but the default judgment shouldn't have stood, and this case was sent back to the district court, could your clients get like an asset freeze to preserve assets until there was a final resolution?
I'm not exactly sure how to answer that, Your Honor, but my clients did certainly reach out to the appellants in this matter well before trial and to discuss assets and so forth, and all requests were denied.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Taking it over, I will give your client 6 minutes for a bow if you want to, because we'll take one each for at the end of the time you're taking. So 2 minutes for both of us together.
Yeah.
So you got one each and one split.
Two points. One, there's also no evidence in the record whatsoever that any effort was made to serve Mr. Chan personally before the attempted service on the law firm in California. There's absolutely zero. Two, back to subject matter jurisdiction, I would just ask this court to look at the evidence that was presented by both sides from the same point as though Mr. Chan were asking to invoke diversity jurisdiction, claiming he was a resident of Maryland. I think if you view it through that prism, it becomes apparent as to how deficient that evidence would be. And to answer your question, Judge Gould, whether it's an abuse of discretion or de novo, in this case, clearly a mistake has been made, and the judgment on that regard, or the decision of the lower court on jurisdiction, needs to be reversed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With regard to the notice of this lawsuit, opposing counsel references these articles in the Korea Times, but it's important to note that the articles in the Korea Times were not in front of the district court at the time the motion to set aside the default was brought to the court, because those articles were not raised until April of 2013. But importantly, also, the Second Amendment complaint was filed in November, which means that the articles showed no knowledge whatsoever about the amended complaint. But here's the thing, notice isn't enough. Just knowing about a lawsuit isn't enough. You, under Ninth Circuit authority, you actually have to be served personally, at least in attempts, and even a good attempt. And the Ninth Circuit case in Borzenica says that there's four problems that you have to satisfy before you can say, okay, notice is enough. Those standards include that there's a justifiable excuse for the failure to serve. Here, there wasn't even an attempt at service. And what opposing counsel has left off with regard to the discussion about serving him in New Jersey is that they didn't even hire a process server. They had an employee at Jeff Solder go and do some Google searches. That is not enough. They need to hire a process server. And they went to his house two times. They knew about 45 minutes from JFK. He lives somewhere right around there. A process server. And also, Mr. Kim is actually knowledgeable or well-known in the New York media. I could find it. So, in any case, there wasn't due diligence. And the notice wasn't of the Second Amendment complaint, which is two plaintiffs and $1 million. And moreover, notice isn't the standard. And he reasonably thought he could wait to be served. And also that he could rely on his co-defendant. One last point, and this is actually, I think, important, I would submit. This court must consider the economic loss rule here because, as a matter of law, it would dismiss with prejudice the tort claims asserted against both Kim and Chung. I would submit that under Arizona Supreme Court decisions that the economic loss rule absolutely applies. applies here. There's no Arizona Supreme Court decision that addresses intentional frauds, but the Cook decision is the Arizona Court of Appeals, and it absolutely applies it to fraudulent inducement, the very tort alleged here, as well as intentional misrepresentation, and finds that the economic loss rule applies. The reason that I think it's framed here, oh, sorry.
So why does it matter whether there's a tort remedy if there's a contract remedy for the same amount?
Exactly. That is why the economic loss rule applies here. There is not one claim of damage here that is not satisfied through a breach of contract claim, so they should be limited to the breach of contract claims. Now, if the question that you're asking is why does it matter, it matters here because it's only through the tort claims that they are asserting alter ego to get personal liability for Mr. Kim as to all the defendants here. He's being held liable because of the tort claims for every tort committed by any party in this matter, including the bad guy. That is why it's incorrect.
Why wouldn't there's been an alter ego finding that doesn't potentially get disturbed, why wouldn't that also come to the breach of contract claim?
It can. Alter ego often is asserted in a breach of contract case, but here, when you review the Second Amendment complaint, the only basis for piercing the corporate veil is the fraud claim. If the fraud claim is disallowed because of the economic loss rule, plaintiffs failed to assert the breach of contract mechanism for alter ego. This would be commission access or failure to observe the corporate form or anything beyond the boilerplate comment that it's a sham corporation. What links it to Mr. Kim or Mr. Chung? There's not one allegation, and the reason is there's not one shred of evidence that didn't happen. So, I also want to address one last comment about Mr. Kim as the CEO. He became the CEO in name only 2 years before this lawsuit was filed. His role was in no way like a traditional CEO, and if he was permitted to defend on the merits, they would show what his role was. He did not know what Young was doing, and indeed, a professional crook is not so easy.
That's going to be your last comment. Thank you very much. The case just argued will be submitted, and we are adjourned for today's hearing.